All right, thanks for coming, guys. Let's roll here. So we were examining the life of Moses and the journey that God takes him on, and the people that he's charged with leading, and it's been a ton of fun so far. We're really coming to this is the pinnacle in terms of the way Israelites or Jewish people look at the story of the Exodus, the journey to freedom. This is the pinnacle of this entire event, which is no small thing, and we'll talk about this more in just a minute. But before we start tonight, I'd love for you to be able to invite God into your time tonight to be able to hear from him. So, God, what a gift that worship is, and what a neat thing it is to be able to sing and extol your greatness through music. And thanks for the way music has the power to both move our soul and captivate our mind with thoughts and ideas about what it means to love you, and also just to be able to recognize what an awesome and amazing God you are. So thanks for the gift of worship. Thanks for this unique opportunity we have each week to gather together as a group of people that, and we want to know you more, we want to love you, and we want to serve you well. And so would you use our time together tonight in the Word in the next couple of minutes here to help us become more aware of what that looks like in each one of our lives and for us as Sierra Community Church to do that well. So we got to sing about Jesus and how worthy he is and what he's done for us. And it's that reminder, that's why we always pray in his name, because he is worthy and because he has done so much for us. So thank you, Father, for Jesus. Amen. Thanks for coming tonight, guys. So, it's funny the way things work out. And tonight, I'm going to be doing 5 chapters of the book of Exodus. And so, as Billy Graham used to say, when the lights were low and people were getting antsy, worrying about the buses taken off without them at the end of a service, don't worry, we'll keep the buses waiting for you tonight. So, because we got a long section to hammer through tonight, to hopefully to make it a little more brief for you, you can see up there and in your notes, I printed this out in your notes also. We're just going to go through just a couple verses in chapter 19. We're going to do the very first commandment of the 10 commandments in there and in chapter 20, and then we're going to kind of read the epilogue of Moses's and the people's meeting with God in Sinai, where God delivered the law to them. So if you have your Bibles, open up to Exodus chapter 19. It's the second book in your Bible. It's not very far in there. We're not going to read the first 8 verses. We're going to read verses 2 through 6, and then we'll just skip over one chapter, chapter 20, and then like I said, we'll go back to chapter 24. If you don't have your Bibles tonight, it's all printed out in your notes there for you also. So this is what it says. It says, after they set out from Rephidim, they entered the desert of Sinai, and Israel camped there in the desert in front of the mountain. Then Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain and said, this is what you are to say to the house of Jacob and what you are to tell the people of Israel. You yourself have seen what I did to Egypt, how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Isn't that interesting? Notice he doesn't say, I brought you out here to the desert. What does he say? I brought you here to me. Beautiful, huh? Now, if you obey me fully and keep my commands, then out of the nations, you'll be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Now, skip over to chapter 20, the first 3 verses. It says, and God spoke all these words. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. And you flip over just a little bit to chapter 24. And this really odd scene where it says, then he, and this is Moses, it says, then he took the book of the covenant and he read it to the people. They responded, we will do everything the Lord has said. We will obey. Now, if you have your Bibles with you and you have a pen, I'd love for you in the margin right there to write in there, liar, liars, pants on fires, right? Because if you know the rest of the story or even the story to this part, up to this point, The people, you know, God's done amazing things, and the people just don't seem, they don't seem like they're real committed to, you know, that song that we sang, and we're going to sing it at the end. You know, I owe all to you. You know, and certainly if people could have recognized what it meant that I owe all to you, these were people that experienced God doing all for them, and they hadn't done a great job to this point to being willing participants to follow him well. So they say that grandiose statement. They're gonna say we're all in here. Verse 8. Moses then took the blood, sprinkled it on the people, and he said, "This is the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words." Is that bizarre or what? Blood. So at the end of their promise, he sprinkles blood on them. We'll talk about why in the world they would do that. Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu. If you're looking for weird names for your kids, you got a couple right there. And the 70 elders of Israel went up, and they saw the God of Israel. Under his feet was something like a pavement of sapphire, clear as the sky itself. But God did not raise his hand against these leaders of the Israelites. They saw God, and they ate, and they drank. So this is a picture of hospitality. The people come up there. It's like God invites them in. And most of the time when you read in the Bible, when people meet God face to face, it wasn't something that people looked forward to because it didn't turn out well for people. People rarely walked away alive after meeting with God face to face. And this not only says, not only did they live, but there's this picture of the way that you showed that you accepted and loved someone was you'd invite them into your house to be able to enjoy sitting down. Because a meal wasn't like, you know, you come over at 5 o'clock, we eat at 6, and then you're done at 7:30 or 8 and go home. Meals lasted all day. This was a way of inviting someone in to enjoy being with you. That's what God does here with these guys. He invites them in. He wants to be with them. So I want to walk through some of this stuff with you. One of the things that's interesting is, it's fascinating, people's, you know, our country was founded on Christian and Judeo Old Testament principles. You go back and you read our founding documents, and they appeal not just to the Old Testament, but even to the person of Moses. And so, you know, our country, in fact, most of the Western world has sort of been built on the foundation of the law and ethics that's talked about in these chapters. But it's also pretty evident that sort of the basic knowledge of the Bible has been eroding, maybe even rapidly, you'd say, in our culture. And here's a great, great video that illustrates this so well.
What were Jesus' parents' names?
Mary and Joseph.
Very good.
Yes,
very good.
I got that one.
Very good. And approximately how many years ago did he live?
Oh, gosh. 250 million years ago.
Okay, how many wise men were there?
12.
All right, what did they bring Jesus as gifts?
They brought him some wine.
Who found the burning bush?
Nixon?
Nixon? What happened in the fight between David and Goliath? The story.
They got in a fight with rocks.
Who won?
Goliath.
Who was swallowed by the whale?
Okay, now I'm on the spot.
Joe?
DiMaggio?
Cain and?
Abel.
That's right. And who were they?
Sitcom.
The Old Testament was originally written in what language?
Isn't it Old English?
Old English.
Or Latin or something?
Old English script.
How many apostles were there?
40.
On the night he was betrayed, Jesus sat with his apostles to eat and drink. The check was enormous.
Adrian, finish this line from the Bible. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's
car.
It's funny to laugh at, but I wonder sometimes how much better you would do if you were on the spot with some of these things. Now, don't you desperately want to help these poor people, like especially the one lady with Who Swallowed the Whale? Fortunately, at least she doesn't say Pinocchio, right? I mean, that's, we'll give her that. So, but here's the thing. We're talking about the Ten Commandments specifically, and in 2007, USA Today, based on a Barna research study, said Americans get an F in religion and religious history. It says sometimes dumb sounds cute, like the video we just watched. 60% of Americans can't name 5 of the Ten Commandments. And 50% of school seniors think Sodom and Gomorrah were married. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's kind of funny, but at the same time, to understand what makes America unique in the world, you're going to miss a lot if you don't appreciate and understand the traditions and the teachings, the foundational teachings of the Old Testament, specifically in the Ten Commandments. Now, I know most of you would say 60% of Americans can't get 5 of the Ten Commandments. Well, here's the good news. Pull out your bulletins, and this is not an open book test. But I'm going to give you the opportunity to prove how much smarter you are than 6 out of 10 Americans. So I'm going to let you list in order as best you can the 10 commandments and the one other place in the scripture where they're listed. So now it's not an open book test, but I'm going to let you collaborate with the other people in your row or around you. So feel free to talk with other people because surely there's somebody smarter than you in your row that can help you out with this stuff. So I'll give you 30 or 40 seconds here, so you have to write and think fast. Some of you are like, oh, I don't have a pen. I'd really like to do this. I know them all, but I don't have a pen or a pencil. I had my own kids in here this morning. I made them take the test, too. No, you're sitting on it, probably. It's hiding in your Bible right there. You got the notes. Yeah. I see. That's what everybody says. Let's see how our worship team back here in the back row is doing. That's pretty impressive. We're doing good. Mm-hmm. Julie, what about the leader of our women's ministry? Let's see how Julie did. Look at that. I like it, Julie. That makes me feel good. I like it. Excellent. All right, 10 more seconds. 10 more seconds. All right, as fast as you can. 10 seconds. All right, let's see if you're smarter than 6 out of 10 Americans. Shout them out as we go through here. Number 1 was a giveaway because I already did it for you, which was what? Yeah, I have no other gods before me. Exactly. I love that. Everybody got that right, correct? Number 2, don't make yourself, if you said idols or graven images, I'll give you credit for either one of those. Number 3, don't misuse the name of the Lord. Now, this one of the things that's interesting about this is, like, I bet that there are a couple people in here that wrote down all 10 of them. But one of the things that's interesting is I think that that even if you can name all 10, there's a good chance that you don't know the actual meaning behind some of these. And this is a really good one because the idea here of misusing the name of the Lord is not that you would say Jesus Christ in an inopportune or in a sarcastic matter, using his name lightly. It actually isn't about that. Really, in Hebrew, what this means is this is the idea of carrying God's name. So it's a picture of you if you claim to be a follower of God and you take him seriously. Everywhere you go, what do? You, in a sense, you're carrying God and his name, his reputation with you. Don't miscarry his name. Don't misrepresent who God is by the way you carry him around with you. So number 4 is remember the Sabbath. And those of you that have kids downstairs and you want them to hear this one, go down and get them. We'll talk about it for a couple minutes. Honor your father and your mother. Number 6, do not murder. How many of you have on that do not kill? You don't get credit for that, actually, because Hebrew has a distinction between killing someone and the taking of innocent life, which is murder, and that's specifically what it's talking about here is do not murder. Number 7, don't commit adultery. Number 8, do not steal. Number 9, don't lie when you're asked to give legally binding testimony about something. So this is specifically not just in a court of law, but this is if someone asks you, this is a sense in which someone asks you, why are you a follower of God, or why is it that you in a legal sense claim to be under his authority? Don't lie. Make sure you're prepared to give an honest, accurate information about that. The last one is don't covet. And where, what book is it found in? Anybody know what other book the Ten Commandments are listed in? Deuteronomy, I like it. Yeah, Deuteronomy chapter 5, very good. Well, I want to run through with you a couple of things here. So first of all, I got two things that I want you to think about, because actually the place where this takes place is very important to this whole story and this account. So this is actually a picture from the Sinai Peninsula, and there isn't, we don't really know, there isn't like a specific mountain that we know is where Moses and the elders went up to meet with God. We don't actually know where this is. Down in that region, there's all sorts of mountains, and you really get a sense of what that looks like. It's a very rugged area, and so that's why it's such a miracle that God provided for the people for as long as he did, not just food, but also water out there. And we're not sure which one of these high points or plateaus Moses went up to was the actual one, because there's a whole bunch of sections in this mountain range down there. But the reason this is important is because if you look at a map and the geography of this area of the world, everywhere you look has a king or a kingdom. And primarily the reason why the Sinai Peninsula doesn't have one is because it's not rich in natural resources. So nobody really wanted to be in control or inhabit this area of the world. So it's interesting that God would bring them out to what? He brings them out to a place that there is no authority, there's no ruler, there's no political hierarchy that the people can be owned by. And why is that? Because God's making a covenant that he will be their owner. The people will belong to him. He will bring them, he will be their king. So what better place to go out? There wasn't anyone else that was in charge of this area. What a better place to be able to say, I'm going to start a new community, a new kingdom in the world, and I'm taking you out because I want you to know that you will be my people and I'll be your king. I'll be your God. That's why he brings him out there. Now, the other thing that's really fascinating about this is God reiterates something really interesting. And it's so important that this comes before he gives them a word of the teachings. Before he tells them anything about the Ten Commandments or anything that follows. Notice what he says here, and this is so significant. It's so significant that it ought to change the way you, for the rest of your life, will ever think about the commandments or the teachings. Because in Judaism, you know what? They don't call them the Ten Commandments. They call them the Ten Words or the teachings. Because in their mind, they thought of this is God's gift to help us understand him and what it means to follow him or live for him well. So they didn't think of these as like laws, a list of do's and don'ts. And I'll tell you why this is so significant. Because God says to them right at the outset, he says, it was because of my love for you that I rescued you. And remember, I did it in my own power. Before you could or were worshiping me, all you were doing was crying out. And it was my power alone that brought you out of Egypt. It was, and see, it, what God says is, it wasn't because you were doing everything right. It wasn't, I didn't do this because I saw that you amongst all the people of the world, if I brought you out of Egypt, that you would do a better job of loving me than anybody else in the world. In fact, that's kind of crazy, isn't it? It's crazy to think that God would rescue them out of Egypt because he said, you guys are special. You're really going to do this well. Because that would mean that God wasn't very smart because the people don't do a very good job. God, in his own power, brings them salvation, freedom. They didn't fight Pharaoh. It wasn't because of their might. It was because of God's hand and his power that delivered them, that purchased salvation and freedom for them. See, and this is so important because too many people think that the teachings, the Ten Commandments and everything that follows, too many people think that, you know what, this is a list that God gave us so that we know when we do these things right, then he'll bless us. But you see, that's not what happens here. God blessed, provided, and took care of the people before they were able to do anything to respond. He already blessed them. He already made the provision for people to receive his goodness before they did anything, before they were able in any way to do any sort of reciprocal thing for God. In fact, they didn't even know God's heart to really genuinely know how to respond to him. And see, that's the beautiful thing about the teachings, is they reveal something not just about how to live, but they tell us ultimately something about God and who he is, about what makes him unique in the world, and what is supposed to make us enjoy the very blessings that he designed us to experience in life. See, this is the thing that's so different about Christianity and Judaism. Unlike all other religions, especially at the time, that were built on individuals, they built their cities around mountains, and they would go up to the temples. And to earn the favor of the gods or the blessings of the god, they'd trudge up there with their sacrifices. And it was their way of saying, look at us, pay attention to us, do something good for us, because look at all that we're doing for you. And God does the exact opposite. Before he asks the people to come up, he comes down, and he's the one who displays all of the power. He's the one who sacrificed for them and then calls the people up to himself. See, this is why Paul in Romans, he says, it's because God first loved us. See, God doesn't bless us because we're so special or we did these amazing things. It's because of his goodness. Why, when we sing that song, I owe all to you. Was it because you did something special for God? Did he die on the cross because he saw you and goes, oh my gosh, these people were going to be better than anybody else in the world for me? No. See, this was his generous gift to show the lengths that he would go to help us experience the blessing in spite of our obedience. See, that's what the good news is all about. It's not so this ought to change the way when we think about the commandments. The commandments can't exist so that like they work as a ladder. If I do these things, God will then bless me. Why not? Because God's already provided the blessing for you. So the purpose of the commandments, they can't be for you to earn God's favor or salvation. That can't be what they exist for. See, what the law does do is it does a couple of things. Number one is it shows us something about God and what's really of value to him. And when we know that, it gives us the opportunity to respond to him, to reciprocate to him in a way that we otherwise couldn't. You know, one of the things that I do when I do counseling, marriage counseling, is one of the things I'm curious of is if God made us in marriage, if he made us to sacrificially love our spouse, love is an interesting word, and love primarily means that you know someone well, and your desire is to serve them well. Well, you know, the thing that's interesting about this is everybody is different. And if you really love your spouse, what that means is that you become a student of them. Why would you become a student of them? Because what? You want to know what's important to them, because each person has their own unique love language. And if you're going to really love someone well, you can't love them in a way that you best receive love, because their love language might be different than yours. See, if you feel love because someone gives you gifts, typically what that means is you will be a gift giver. You'll express love through gifts. But what if your spouse... what if your spouse doesn't want gifts? What if their love language is time? if you really love them, you become a student of them, and you know what makes them tick. You know what makes them feel loved and appreciated. So what you do is you start responding in a way that most helps them know how much you love and appreciate them. See, God is doing something really, it's kind of dangerous here. He's revealing sort of his love language to us. And it's sort of a dangerous thing because he's making himself vulnerable. Because who wants to become vulnerable and show someone what it means to love you and then have people not love you well? But do you see that? That's what God is doing here. See, the rabbis have this interesting way of thinking about the law. They teach. This probably did not happen, but they had this way of saying, we understand what a gift God is giving us. Because what he's doing is he's revealing in his law something about himself that will help us love him well. And they realized this is big information. This is important information. If we're going to enter into a real intimate relationship with God, he's giving us the keys to doing that. And so the rabbis told the story like this. They said, Moses goes up on the mountain and he says, you know what? I know what you're going to give us is of great value. What do you want in return? And Moses says to him, he says, we will put on the line our heritage, that if we don't show appreciation for the gift you're going to give us, then you can cut us off from all of the promises that you gave our forefathers, our family. And to the Jewish people, that was a big deal. They hung on to that national identity. It was a huge deal to them. And they said, we'll put that on the line. If you're going to give this to us, God, and we fail, cut us off. And God says to him, no, that's what I have for you is too valuable. That's not it. Moses comes back down the mountain. He asks the people and he says to them, that didn't do it. So what could we offer God to get this good gift? And the people say, well, go back up there and tell him we'll give him our lives. So Moses goes back up there and he says to God, look, okay, rather than our heritage, we'll put our own lives on the line. And God says to him, no, that's not valuable enough for what I'm going to give you. What? Moses goes back down and he's thinking and gets the people together and he says, God says, no, he's not going to give it to us on that basis. And the people say, well, what's most dear to us? And being a family-oriented culture, they said, well, our children. I thought about this because I sort of use this story in a way to help you appreciate this. You know, Moses goes back up and he says to God, he says, all right, we'll put our children, if we don't take this seriously, you can have our children. It'll cost us our children. And God says to Moses, now you're getting to why this is so precious. Why would he do that? It's interesting that Judaism would recognize this because ultimately the giving of the gift of the teachings will cost who? His son. God says, you're getting to understand how important this is because it's going to cost not you, your children, but it will cost me mine. Now, I got to tell you, it was a weird thing happened to me. After I told this story both services this morning and second service, after the service, I'm hanging out in the back and I'm talking with this one family and they have a newborn baby and they're holding their baby and it's their first child. And I stopped and I thought about this. And I thought, you know, genuinely, this is what God is saying. He said the very thing this family, I can't imagine them going, we'll make a deal with God. You give us something precious and we'll put our child's life on the line. No way, man. You know, no way. But you know what? That's exactly what God does. He says, I'll give you this great gift. And even if you don't take it seriously and we enter into an agreement here, a promise, it's going to cost something significant for the failure of it. And God put the most precious beans on the table in that regard. What this is about is helping you think about what does it mean to respond to God, not just out of obedience. Because I think that if you go back and you listen to the majority of the way that Noah talks about God and what it means to respond to him. Most of the time, I talk about it as a duty. I don't care if you feel like honoring God. It's the right thing to do. You do it. And you know what? There's truth to that. It is not just all about your feelings. The other side of that, though, is God gave us a heart. And in a relationship, you don't, if you really are inclined towards someone, it means that you want to respond not just because it's a duty, but because you have a heart change. So Thursday night, I'm playing a board game with my three older kids and my wife. And we're playing this board game, and my two youngest kids are watching this show on Netflix. It's a real short little episodes. And it's got this kind of catchy tune to it. And I had never heard it before. And so I get distracted by hearing this and kind of like, what are they watching? What is the show? And it's a show called Masha and the Bear. And it really is Masha. It's not Marsha because it's made by Russians. And the little girl looks like a Russian girl. It's really cute. So the story goes like this. There's this little girl. She loves this bear. And she just wants to be with the bear and play with the bear and have the bear's attention. And the bear is kind of an independent guy. And he thinks it's cute and he sort of gets sucked into this whole thing. But really, he just sort of wants... He's sort of his own guy and wants to do his own thing. And the little girl very oftentimes makes it difficult for the bear. So in this episode, it's called the Jam Season. The bear, like all bears, loves berries. So he goes and he spends a lot of time gathering and harvesting the berries, makes the jam, gets it all ready. He's all excited about it because it's ready to eat. And that's why he's got the jar on his fist there. And he gets it stuck in there, but he wants to put the jam in there. So Masha wants to help the bear get the jar off.
Let me help you.
Bear goes off, and he's intent on regathering all the berries that have been lost and destroyed to make another batch of jam. And he has horrible luck.
And Masha thinks, oh, poor bear. So she gets this bright idea why bear is out. She gets all the local animals together, and they go out, and they harvest what is available right there. And they put together a feast. So bear comes back totally depressed because it's been a horrible effort trying to recapture all the fruit that's been lost. This is what happens.
Bear, where have you been? Everything is ready already.
You see that look on her face? Why is she so happy? Did she enjoy a sip or a lick of any of that good food? She does it why? Purely motivated because she knows what makes the bear happy and where does she find great joy? See, when you really love someone, your deepest sense of joy is in loving and finding that the other person you're serving, not a benefit to yourself, but your greatest joy comes when the person you love the most is happy. And there's a sense in which when you really love someone, if they're not happy, it's very difficult for you to be at peace. See, and I have this sense that what happens here in the giving of the commandments is God is saying, I want you to know how to love me. And it'll be of great benefit to you because you'll be able to live at peace with yourself. But also, it will bring me joy. See, that's why do you notice the language at the beginning of the passage that I read to you? That's what it says. It doesn't say, obey me just because I've done all this. What it says is, it says, when you do this, you'll become my treasured possession. In chapter 19, right? He says, the whole earth is mine. Everybody belongs to me. It all belongs to me. But you know, when you get this right and you enjoy the way I designed life to live, and you, when you reciprocate because of all that I've done for you, and your heart's changed because you love me, you'll become my treasured possession. And what the language here is the language of a king in the Old Testament. A king owned everything. It all belonged to him. But a king had a treasured possession. And that's what he liked to show off. Look at what I got right here. You see how cool this is? See, and that's why genuinely there's a sense that knowing God, you don't earn his favor because the blessing's already available to you. But the law, the commandments, the teachings, they tell us about God, they tell us about who he is, they tell us about his heart, and it gives us the opportunity to know his love language and to love him well. Now, one of the things that's kind of scary about this is, if it'll give us a chance to examine our hearts, but see what was God's purpose in this? Remember, he wanted to make a holy nation. His laws and what they did is they created a culture unlike anything else that was going on in the world. And I kind of wonder about this. Maybe you would think that it's true that these ideas are so radical that not only were they different for the time when they were written, but maybe they would be really radical if we lived these things out today. This is like 4,000 years later. Maybe these things would be really radical for us 3,500 years later. Maybe these would be really radical for us because these laws, they talk about the most powerful things in life, sex, money, power. And I kind of think that God was saying to the people that he gave these to, if you live these things out well, you'll change the world. The world will be attracted and desire what you have. And what you'll be doing is saying something about me. You'll be saying something about God when you embody this stuff well. Just think about this for a minute. Sex is such a powerful thing, and it's so misused in our world today. And it was misused in their world. And these teachings, they were so revolutionary. Some people say the Bible, it was written by a bunch of men, patriarchal power, and so why should I listen to this book written by men, for men? You know what? These commandments are the first ones that condemn not just women for adultery, but men too, and said men can't philander. In fact, if you read these carefully, they say you can't have more than one wife. The people weren't real good at obeying any of these things. But clearly God says sex is something to be used not as an exploitive way, but in a way to honor one specific partner that you're committed to. Totally a revolutionary way of thinking about what sex was for and about. A gift to be shared mutually between two people that love each other and want to share the most intimate thing they can with each other. Women didn't, in all the rest of the cultures, women had no legal rights and they didn't have the rights to inherit any land. And this was the first culture that said women can have the same legal standing as men do, as the boys did, to inherit possessions and land and have legal title to them. Think about power. Deuteronomy chapter 15. Says you can't use economic power at the cost of exploiting other people. The thing that was most valuable, just like it is today in many respects, is real estate. And if you bought real estate from somebody, every 7 years, the law said you, whoever owned that land, gets it back. So it was a way of saying you can't exploit or monopolize, use your money power
on the backs of other people so they can't enjoy, have the opportunity to enjoy the same thing you do. So if you bought land and it was a year, 1 year before the seventh year, you just bought the land at the price of whatever you thought the land was going to produce. So it would benefit you, but also it would benefit the owner, and the owner eventually would have the opportunity to have that land back. So you couldn't exploit people with means of power economically. And money, so I told you, you can do your, you can get your tax statement. Some of you will turn that in, and you may get back, you know, that you gave 8 or 10, maybe even 11% to charity this last year between giving to Sierra Community Church and other nonprofit organizations. And you might go, 10%? Man, that's pretty good. You know, you talk about revolutionary. These teachings told people from the richest to the poorest, everybody. It kind of depends on how you do the math with one of the passages. But every year, 23.5% to 28% of your material wealth that you got every year, you had to give away. Is that radical? I mean, I want you to think about this. See, what if Sierra Community Church was the kind of place that embodied this? What if we treated sex as something sacred, as a mutual gift, only to be shared with our spouses? And what if our kids grew up with a commitment to do the same thing? See, and what if our ideas about how we used our gifts, our abilities, our talents, not in a way specifically to enrich our own lives or draw attention to ourselves, but to enrich and bless the lives of other people? And what if we lived in a kind of community here, a nation, a people that made sure that from the richest to the poorest, we were all taking care of one another's physical and material needs? See, I don't know. I don't know if this is true or not. But if people take these things seriously, you see, Donald Trump will not bring about revolution, people. Hillary Clinton will not bring about revolution that we want. There is no political organization or entity that's ever been able to do this. But you tell me that what we just talked about and what God says, this is what life in a community that's committed to me, that loves me, that values me, you tell me that that's not revolutionary and that that won't bring change. And I would say this, that if we can do this stuff well, as a community, as a nation, that's what God was calling out. If we're a community like this, committed to this, you tell me that our neighbors and the people in our town won't see that and tell me they wouldn't be attracted to go, there's something different there that's beautiful. That people will want to be a... See, our hope for people coming to know Christ and to be committed to God, it's not on how good a speaker Dan is. And he's good. Thankfully, it's not on how good a teacher Noah is, because we'd be in big trouble, right? But what God says is, I want you to embody all that I love and that I'm passionate about. And when you do that well, other people will have the opportunity to see me. And see, here's the thing. This is why this is about a nation. Because the language here is priests, that you're all priests. And we're doing this together. This is the problem with English, is we don't have a good way of second person, you know, first person plurals. Only if you live in the South do you get the language that's being used here. It's saying, y'all. When y'all do this, it's when you and you and you, but it is individual, but it's saying when y'all, when we all do this, we all get this, we all do it well, we live together, this kind of community, it'll change things. And that's why Jesus says, he says, I want people to experience the unity that I have with the Father. And that when people do this and they live with me, what will happen? The world will believe that you've sent me. It's exactly what Jesus is appealing to. The last thing in here about the law is it gives us, because it's about God and who he is and his priorities, it kind of gives you the opportunity to look at your own heart and go, some principles, some things that I love, that I desire, that's what guides my life. And it can, you know what I'll tell you, man?
You just have to wrestle with this for a little while tonight. I've been having to wrestle with this for a week and a half now, man. It's scary to ask yourself, is my heart really passionate about the things that God is? Is my life really guided and directed and pushed towards the things that God is passionate about? And sometimes we think that the law, you know, the law is, you know, it's for those old, the people a long time ago. But, you know, Jesus even says, don't think that I don't think this stuff is important. Don't think that I came to abolish this. I haven't. I've come to fulfill everything that these guys talked about, even the prophets, to fulfill all of this stuff. Last thing. So, weird picture of the blood. And one of the things you guys know I like to do is illustration. So, I brought my own jar of blood here to sprinkle on you. You're thankful that I don't. But you know what my wife said to me? She said, can you imagine? These people probably didn't have very many sets of clothes. And when Moses does this, sprinkles blood on them. Talk about a regular reminder. See, and what the people were committing themselves to, right, is what? Moses took these things. He read it to them. And they responded, we'll do everything the Lord has said. We'll obey. Moses then takes the blood. He sprinkles it on the people. And he said, this is the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you. That's interesting because what's going on in here is they didn't have legal contracts the way you and I go to a lawyer and have, I'll do this, you do that, and this is our mutual agreement. And if someone breaks it, here's what will happen. See, this was their way of saying, if we break our promise to obey these things, blood. It'll be our blood. See, they're taking this very seriously. Now, why would they enter into this agreement? Because they recognize that God is going to give them something that they can't get any other way. And that's the good blessing of life that he offers them. And of course they go, we want that. We want the good thing that God offers us. And we'll commit ourselves to loving you back. And if we don't commit ourselves to being your nation, your holy people, we'll even put our lives on the line. What a short-sighted deal to enter into to say, we'll do all this stuff because there was no way they could do it. And you know what? What a gracious God that said, I know you can't live up to this. I know you can't possibly fulfill all the things that I designed for you to do. So you know what? God made a provision for them. Even in this, God says, what you're unable to do, I want to make sure that you can enjoy me. And not, see, they were said, if they failed, they would be cut off from God. And God says, no, I'll make a provision. So even in your failure, you won't be cut off from me. What a beautiful thing. And so that was the animal substitute of the lot. The animal substituted their place for their inability or their unwillingness to follow God. And the neat thing is, see, this isn't just for Sinai and those people. It's for us too. Because many years later, God shows his love for us. And he said, I'll take care of wherever you fail to, because I don't want you to be cut off from me. See, when Jesus, when he's eating that Last Supper with his good friends, and he says, this blood, it's the symbol of the covenant. The good little Jewish boys sitting around with him, they all knew exactly what he was talking about. They all knew that he was referring back to the blood of the covenant. They all knew that. See, Jesus is saying, one time I'll take care of your inability because I don't want you to be cut off from enjoying the good life that I have for you and the blessings I have for you. So that's why our worship team's going to come back up and we're going to say, I owe all to you. I owe all to you because you're great and amazing. It's unfathomable, the goodness that God displays throughout all time and that you and I get to take advantage of all the time. So if our worship team, if you guys will come up here, it'd be great. Normally what we do is I say, hey, while they're playing, the ushers are going to come and do offering. We're not going to do that. I want you guys to be able to enjoy singing tonight. It's part of our service. And we'll do our offering afterwards. And when the baskets come by, you can put in your 25% then. Enjoy singing. I owe all to you.